Hi, I'm Moji Alawodeyau from the Feminist Buzzkills Live Pod, the only podcast that helps you navigate the news in this post-pro anti-abortion hellscape. Each week, with co-host Liz Winstead, we dissect all the news from that sketchy intersection of abortion and misogyny with providers and activists working on the ground. The cherry on top is we have amazing comedy guests who help us laugh through the rage. Feminist Buzzkills Live drops Fridays wherever you pod. Listen and subscribe, because when BS is popping, we pop off.
MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
Hi there, I'm Jeff Stein, and this is Spy Talk. What a week, huh? Like most people around here, I've been stunned by the mass house cleaning, as Trump partisans call it, at the Justice Department, the White House National Security Council, the Pentagon, the FBI, and now the CIA, where anyone who was associated with the investigations of rioters and conspirators in the January 6, 2021 assault on the U.S. Capitol are being hunted down and forced to quit. There's been almost no attention, meanwhile, paid to the Department of Homeland Security's intelligence shop beyond the arrival of North Dakota Governor Kristi Noem as its new boss and the mass deportations being carried out under her purview. But DHS does indeed have an intelligence wing, and a very controversial one at that, which has earned negative reviews for years under both Republican and Democratic administrations, who've accused it of spying on innocent Americans. Is that likely to continue under President Trump, who made no secret of wanting to root out what he calls radical Marxists and leftists everywhere he looks? Here to talk about that troubled past and unknown future of INA, DHS's Intelligence and Analysis Unit, is Spencer Reynolds, who from 2015 to 2021 was Senior Intelligence Counsel and DHS's General Counsel's office, where he advised on operations and policy related to domestic intelligence, counterterrorism, social media monitoring, very controversial, and other national security matters. Today, he's Senior Counsel in the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU Law School. Spencer Reynolds, welcome to Spy Talk. Now, we're going to talk today about the troubled, I don't think that's an exaggeration, the troubled DHS intelligence shop. Now, I was there at the creation of DHS as Homeland Security Editor at Congressional Quarterly back in 2002. And onward. And I always thought that DHS, along with many other people thought this, was DHS itself was kind of a Rosemary's baby of national security. One of the few things I agreed with President George W. Bush about was the creation of DHS. He didn't want to do it. It was pressed on him by Democrats, wanted to do something after the shock of 9/11. So they created the sprawling DHS, which was an amalgamation of several security agencies, immigration, just sprawling. And intelligence was created as a shop inside DHS. And it's never quite found a rightful home or a function. And I'd say it was the Rosemary's baby of the Rosemary's baby. So you have vast experience inside DHS and dealing with intelligence issues there from a legal standpoint. So let's start with, what is DHS intelligence supposed to be doing?
Sure, Jeff. That's a great question. And thanks for having me to speak with you about this. I really appreciate it. I think this is a really good moment to connect about the Office of Intelligence and Analysis and the broader DHS intelligence enterprise, because there's been efforts after years of trouble and challenges and desire for change. There's been some recent efforts to make some of that happen. So DHS as a department, just stepping back a little bit, has a number of mandates, right? As you noted, it was cobbled together from a lot of different agencies, some of which seem like they naturally fit together. others may be a bit more confusing, like FEMA, for instance, and disaster recovery being alongside border security and counterterrorism. It's not an obvious natural fit, even though there is overlap at times. And so DHS has existed for about 20 years now, and it has all these different mandates and activities. The Office of Intelligence and Analysis is kind of a microcosm of that. It's a mini DHS in that sense. It has a number of different intelligence mandates, national and departmental alike. It's one of DHS's two elements of the U.S. intelligence community, along with parts of the U.S. Coast Guard. So it falls under several governance regimes, right under the Department of Homeland Security, but also under the Director of National Intelligence. It's got one foot in and one foot out of the IC. And
Can I cut through the mustard here for a second?
Sure.
So that's the bureaucratic, you know, landscape. What does it do? Does it coordinate intelligence that's domestic related? Does it collect intelligence? Does it do spying? In fact, there have been allegations that it really overstepped its boundaries by doing spying, so to speak, collecting intelligence from Americans. So
it does all of that and then some. So it carries out part of DHS's mandate to share information between federal, state, and local agencies. So it sits in the IC and takes IC information and makes it available to state and local police, governor's offices, secretaries of state, et cetera. And it also collects information from them and makes it available to the feds. And it does this in a couple of ways. It has intelligence officers spread throughout fusion centers, so intelligence sharing hubs throughout the United States, and embedded with CBP and ICE and others. And it has conversations where it collects intelligence from state and local law enforcement. It also has a program where it participates in jails and detention centers. And that's something that came under scrutiny for a lack of due process and constitutional protections.
And because DHS agents were going into prisons and gathering personal information from unwitting prisoners, was that the gist of it?
Well, DHS maintains a number of detention facilities, right, for migrants and others. And INA,
which is going to explode
absolutely
in the Trump administration.
Absolutely. And the last administration positioned INA to participate heavily in it. They've further codified activities to support CBP and ICE with interviews of people in detention for any sorts of intelligence needs they might have. You know, think narcotics trafficking, human smuggling, that sort of stuff. But they're going into these coercive environments, right? If you're a migrant, you may not speak the local language, you may not understand your rights, and you're in an environment where you're in detention and it's high stakes for you, and you may not understand your ability to speak with an attorney, and you may be talking to this intelligence agency, and you think, oh, they're not law enforcement, it'll be fine. But INA spends a lot of its time providing its information directly to law enforcement. So Congress was concerned about this and passed some prohibitions that have restrictions that require INA to talk with attorneys first.
There are so many questions that are raised by what you've just told us about sort of overstepping their bounds. You know, one of the criticisms of this intelligence and analysis shop is that it's redundant that other agencies do this stuff. For example, you talked about sharing intelligence with state, local authorities and tribes. We already have joint terrorism task forces. We have the FBI in terms of interviewing prisoners and finding out what their backgrounds is. We have the Bureau of Prisons. We have the Justice Department. We have state police. So is there a case to be made? Maybe I'm getting ahead of myself here and ending the interview before it begun. Is there a case of just getting rid of it because it's redundant and it just can wander into areas, which we'll get into, wander into areas that are really problematic?
Yeah. I think that there probably is a lot to talk about before we get to, you know, real full discussion of INA's future. I think so. Supporters and proponents for the office will talk about how INA is uniquely situated, might be a bit of an overstatement, but they're uniquely situated to act as that touch point between federal, state, and local for sharing information. And in some ways, that's true, right? They're able to provide cities and states with federal information and obtain stuff of federal value that maybe otherwise would have slipped through the cracks. I think that is probably an important function that can be done in a non-controversial way. It's not clear that it necessarily would have to be INA that does it. DHS has a number of redundant information sharing regimes. They have offices of partner engagement. They have offices that do liaison work. They have the Homeland Security Information Network, which is about providing information in a shared environment. And when INA is not doing that work, they're also doing social media monitoring, which has gotten them into a lot of trouble because their rules permit targeting Americans' political speech when they can assert that it will support one of their very broad missions. That's taken them to targeting controversial views online, people simply talking about abortion, what they call narratives and grievances, you know, the sort of hot button political topics that people need to be able to engage in.
Let me ask you this. Does that mean that DHS agents, people recruited to INA department, were listening in or monitoring social media?
We're monitoring social media generally?
Yeah, or of suspects, quote unquote, or...
Yeah, so INA is not an investigative agency. It's an intelligence agency. And one of my concerns about it is that they have a broad mandate to look at terrorism information, critical infrastructure information, anything to support another DHS component or DHS leadership, some undefined mission called Other Threats to Homeland Security, which by all appearances may be used to expand INA's mission to hate crimes and potentially previously looking at protesters who were targeting Confederate monuments back in 2020. So right, this is a really big basket of missions that they can engage in. And they do have restrictions. They're only allowed to look at publicly available information, or they're only allowed to have overt conversations with sources. So they say, hi, I'm Spencer. I'm from DHS. I'd like to talk to you about this. And in those contexts, they do look at social media.
But you said that it's not really, I forget your term, action agency or whatever. So who's doing this monitoring? Are there people hired by INA or some component of DHS is monitoring these conversations or following up and querying people?
So when we were looking at DHS intelligence programs a couple of years ago, we identified some 17 or so social media monitoring programs. But if we're talking about INAs specifically, they have employees, they have what they call intelligence officers, employees who are, you know, trained IC officers, and they also have contractors. And those personnel are the ones who do social media monitoring for the agency itself. They work with other agencies. They disseminate this information derived from social media to thousands of police nationwide, other DHS elements. They write analytic reports. So, you know, longer term prose analytic reports based off social media monitoring, but they do it in-house themselves.
Hmm. Okay. So one of the functions is called Homeland Security. So I suppose that they are supposed to be concentrating on real threats to domestic security. Homegrown terrorists, self-starters, self-recruits to ISIS, like we saw in New Orleans, troubled individuals and so on, and suddenly become radicalized. DHS is collecting on that kind of domestic threat. It's a basic thing.
That's correct, right? INA is an agency that is specifically focused on the United States, which supporters and proponents of the agency might also note that that is a unique thing that it brings. But it also then runs into conflict, right? Because when you're looking at Americans on an online speech and things like that, you're going to be often bumping up against First Amendment protected speech and associations and activities and things like that. And their guidelines, which were approved by the Attorney General as required under Executive Order 12333, allow them to target Americans' constitutionally protected speech where they can assert one of those mandates. So the administration that just departed released a policy manual And there's been, you know, documents that have come out over the last few years kind of suggesting how they interpret that. And by all appearances, they take a pretty broad view of what it would mean to do counterterrorism intelligence collection. And it's, you know, information about political speech or potential drivers that may be, you know, disconnected from actual threats and conspiracies and things like that. So around the overturning of Roe v. Wade, INA issued intelligence about people simply talking about abortion politics online under the theory that out of that ether and miasma of online discourse, there might be terrorism threats. Similarly, they have looked at what they call narratives and grievances. So people concerned about things like COVID-19 or election integrity and things like that, where they will draw kind of sweeping conclusions that everybody should be on high alert, that an increase in chatter or increase in discussion may lead to terrorism threats. They've never really connected the dots. And there's a couple of risks and challenges with that. First, from a safety perspective, it runs the risk of clogging up information sharing regimes where state and local and other law enforcement are trying to figure out what the heck is going on. They're relying on the federal government. It can clog it up with not particularly actionable intelligence. And in the past, the FBI referred to INA's intelligence social media program as crap. Other parts of the IC have referred to them as junior varsity. We did a study of available intelligence when we issued a report on the agency a couple of years ago that found that they were writing at times reports that were just easily reviewed and assessed to be based on inaccurate information. So there are, you know, there's safety.
What a mess
there. Yeah, it's a mess, right? I think the reality is that social media monitoring and intelligence is extremely difficult because you're an intel officer sitting at a desk and you're looking at somebody's, you know, a Facebook page or X feed or something like that. You know who this person is. They're anonymous. You're kind of going on that, but you're supposed to be able to understand the context and the contours of their speech and everything around it. And it becomes very difficult to parse through jargon and in jokes and, you know, slang and things like that.
And critics have said, and with a great deal of accuracy, it seems to me, this smacks of Big Brotherism. So moving beyond that, so this is very difficult territory. And it must be said that despite all this monitoring and so on, and 20 years after 9/11, and DHS was created to coordinate intelligence, basically, because that was the big failure of intelligence agencies were not exchanging information on Al-Qaeda's plans. And therefore, the terrorists were able to carry out the massive attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, could have attacked the Capitol had not passengers risen up and taken over an airplane headed to Washington. So you know, years later, along comes the run-up to the January 6th massive mob attack on the Capitol, and DHS dropped the ball. It had intelligence, but it didn't share it. So it seems to me that not only is there some basis to accuse it of Big Brotherism, monitoring the social media habits of innocent Americans, but it's failing in its basic intelligence gathering and analysis function.
Yeah, that's right. I think January 6th was a significant misstep for the agency, sandwiched between two other significant missteps that we can talk about briefly. But you're correct in that inspector general reports, congressional reviews, all of the postmortem deep dives, media coverage made it pretty clear that DHS had some intelligence and that the information sharing environment was pretty chaotic. And that despite all of these, as you say, Big Brother sorts of activities of monitoring speech online and things like that, the office didn't get the warning out. You know, I think other agencies were, you know, looking at it too and responsible for that. And people were watching the media coverage, right? And there were also questions about failures to appropriately resource Capitol Police and law enforcement, right? There's a lot of factors that led to January 6th, but INA, for whatever reason, there did not engage seriously with that situation. And this followed on the heels of the summer of 2020, when INA went all out and committed significant resources along with DHS police to do intelligence activities cracking down on protesters in Portland, Oregon, and elsewhere around racial justice demonstrations. They were caught both creating dossiers on protesters using sensitive and still sometimes undisclosed DHS and federal repositories of information combined with social media information, and also writing intelligence reports about journalists who were covering their material, also while interpreting their broad authorities to say that they could go after people vandalizing Confederate monuments as a threat to homeland security. So they weren't, you know, they were pretty hard on that particular topic. And then several months later, there was a gap around January 6th. And then fast forwarding a little bit further, under the past administration, which was talking up efforts for reform and transparency and strengthening civil rights and civil liberties, INA was also engaged in a month-long campaign of targeting environmentalists and racial justice activists in Atlanta, Georgia, as well as their supporters nationwide, and construing their activities as terrorism, and then providing that information to Georgia authorities who relied on it to issue arrest warrants and charge some 60 plus people under a RICO indictment that has been heavily criticized by civil rights groups. And we've engaged significantly on that at the Brennan Center, where I work, as well as with our partners, and have, you know, looked at the intelligence that's come out of it, and it's been highly questionable. And for me, it's concerning to see, as you noted, a lack of attention around January 6th, and much more significant attention to racial justice demonstrators and environmentalists, especially during a period where the agency was touting reform efforts.
We have to take a break. We'll be back. Okay, we're back. Now, all these abuses, reports of these abuses, and its fuzzy mission and performance propelled Ken Weinstein to take a wrecking ball to the place in 2023. You wrote about that. You called it changing the, what's the cliche, changing the deck chairs on the Titanic. And what was the upshot of that? Were there improvements made? Were there guardrails put in that were helpful? How did that all work out? It seems to me that that was the last big chance to get that place right.
Yeah. It was a significant effort, and I think it's really commendable that they looked at this history and they looked at the challenges of their work and what Ken Weinstein described as a vague mandate, which I think is true. They looked at all of that and the complaints about toxic work culture and how miserable and often confused their staff were with what, you know, the leadership directives they were getting. They looked at all of that and said, we need to seriously investigate and fix this. And I think that's really commendable. And you asked about what lasting changes came out of that. Well, we're talking on February 6th, and it's possible that no lasting changes came out of that. Thanks to the new administration, right? These were all discretionary internal steps that were taken. I'll get into a little bit more detail about what those were, but they culminated in a 228-page policy manual that basically codifies all of INA's guidance, sets out expectations from everything from workforce development to those intel activities we were talking about, and a couple of other reports. Those have just been pulled, as far as we can tell, from the DHS website. So their status is unclear, whether that touchstone piece that came out of this effort that would, you know, set guidance for DHS intelligence going forward, whether it's still in effect. I think there are questions that remain, but so the inquiry that led to that was two stages. First was a look at the organizational structures within INA. And then second was going to be looking at the substantive policies about things like intelligence collection and the agency's priorities. On the first part, you referenced the piece I wrote right after they announced their changes. And the main change that I think affects the sorts of things we're talking about is that they elevated internal oversight. So every IC element has some body that is doing oversight of its intelligence functions, right? There are intelligence experts who are looking at the application of those attorney general guidelines and other sorts of protections and assessing whether they're working and investigating claims that there have been violations of those guidelines. So Undersecretary Weinstein elevated that office slightly within INA, but it still reports to the undersecretary, right? So the idea is that you have, at a domestic intelligence agency where these risks are heightened, you have the oversight actually reporting to the person who is executing all of the intelligence activities. I don't think that's a very good relationship, a very good dynamic. We've prepared a whole plan for building out intelligence oversight within DHS that would elevate that office above INA and above all of the intelligence component intelligence programs that actually have no intelligence oversight, even though they are often more aggressive.
And speaking about oversight, Trump fired all the inspector generals. So we don't have an IG, DHS, overlording the underlords, so to speak. Speaking of the new Trump administration, what do you know about what's going on in the intelligence shop there now? We've had an acting director of intelligence for some time, a woman named Avery Alpha, an intelligence pro, career intelligence officer, came from CIA and had other assignments, State Department and so on, very seasoned. As we speak today, on February 6th, we don't know if she's still there. What do you hear?
Yeah, your guess is as good as mine. I mean, hearing from my friends and people I talk to in Washington, I would say that INA is potentially an important office for the coming administration, right? For all the things that we talked about, also how well it's positioned itself to assist in immigration operations. But it's also not, it's not the CBP or Border Patrol front office, right? It's an intelligence office within DHS. So I think it's probably, its time is coming, I would imagine, for the landing team. And I haven't heard, I don't know who they're planning on posting there.
I have to ask this, too, because we're in such a bizarre, unprecedented time of bureaucratic upheaval. Could INA, we've seen what's going on at the FBI and the Justice Department. They're pursuing policies that Trump wanted to go after enemies, they call them. People worked on the January 6th prosecutions and so on, the Russia investigations and so on. It's clear revenge going on at those agencies. Could INA, could DHS intelligence be recalibrated to target so-called Trump enemies as well?
I think arguably it did do that during the first Trump administration. At INA, those activities in Portland, INA materials and other materials developed by DHS were used by administration officials to cast a wide net in disparaging characterizations of the racial justice movement. CBP intelligence during that period and at other times engaged in sweeping intelligence activities to target journalists without really any oversight, as mm-hmm. well as immigration advocates along the southern border. So I think we've already seen that can happen. And the one effort that I understood from Ken Weinstein's reforms for the office were both to strengthen internal processes and shore up the workforce, but they also wanted to put in place safeguards against potential future abuse, even as in my view, they were also engaging in some similar activities during the same period. And there were, looking at this 228-page manual, it includes a lot of processes for documentation of intelligence activities and documenting justifications for doing things. I think that is really an important step for INA and really any intelligence or government agency, right? They should be able to explain to each other and to oversight of the public what they did, why they did it, why they thought it was appropriate under their authorities. This is something that Brennan Center has been calling for several years. And there's good documentation throughout this this manual that may or may not still be in effect. But what is missing is really any change to those underlying easily abused authorities that we've talked about. And that's what I'm really concerned about, right? None of the actual rules of the game or the standards for conducting intelligence activities appear to be different. INA did not release all of its guidance publicly. So there may be some changes that are under the surface, but I suspect that's not the case. This is not INA's first reorganization. They have shuffled those deck chairs every few years at this point. And agency officials, for good and bad reasons, both want to maintain discretion. They want to be able to pivot to emerging threats and things like that. And they believe that they need maximum flexibility to do that. That also leads to confusion in the workforce and potentials for abuse.
So the short answer is yes.
INA
can be
yes.
used to target people they don't like on the left, or liberals, or Democrats, or prosecutors, whoever. Are there enough career professionals in DHS and their intelligence shop who would put up resist any manipulation or misuse of INA?
Yeah.
To put up a stink?
I think that's a really good question. And I think it's hard to say for a few reasons. I think one of them is what we're seeing across government. And I'm sure by the time this conversation goes up, but things will have radically changed even more than they are now, where you have offices in the government that are purging career people that may be, in their view, misaligned with the administration's priorities. And I think that is coming for the intelligence community. We're seeing it already at FBI. I'm hearing from people around DC that they're expecting for security and intel offices to be experiencing that also. So I think a lot of people will be under pressure to leave government, and they may feel like, oh, I've been here before. I was here in 2017. It was brutal already. I don't want to do this to myself again. I have, I'm 8 years older and I have a family to think about and maybe other job prospects. It's time for me to get out, even if they would like to stay and uphold the rules that they are obligated to. So I think that's one thing. I think the reality is that it's also just really difficult to do that in an environment like DHS, even under the best of times. The oversight reporting channels are difficult to reach. The civil rights and privacy offices, while they may be very well-meaning, are often sidelined and ineffective, including in the past by INA and department leadership. And the current administration has planned to gut them even further. So there may not be a lot of recourse that rank and file intel officers have. And it's also such a heightened and high stress politicized environment when you're looking at Americans day in and day out. Even if you're there and you're not wanting to target Americans for improper reasons, right? You're there because, as I believe probably almost everybody at DHS is there for, you want to protect us. You want to foster public safety and you want to uphold the Constitution. But when push comes to shove, administration priorities, regardless of the administration, are what reign supreme. And it's really tough to expect a GS-7 or a GS-8 to kind of go it alone in that environment. And I think there's probably going to be a lot of fear mongering and a lot of threats as the DHS postmortem on the Portland environment showed already, under what seems like a less stressful environment.
Seems to me you can make the case now that from the liberal standpoint, progressive standpoint, as well as conservative viewpoint, that they should just get together and drive a wooden stake through the heart of INA. We've got to come up with something better. We do have these immediate and stressful threats coming in from China and Russia, manipulation of social media, disinformation programs, and so on. It seems like the FBI has struggled with blunting that, containing that, responding to it. We got tied up in First Amendment protections and so on. No one's quite figured this out, it seems to me. So maybe, people on the right and people on the left should combine together and introduce a bill to just put INA out of business.
It's funny that you say that.
Let me say, look, you were a lawyer in that department. Can we do without INA altogether?
I think that we're probably past due for shuttering at least a portion of INA's operations. I'm talking about those kind of core collection, analysis, and dissemination operations that we've talked about, the social media monitoring and the human collection and the intelligence that often misrepresents or is easily abused or is frankly of not that much value, as numerous commentators in and out of government have said about INA's work. I think there's a case to be made that this last reform effort was really commendable and comprehensive. But as I suggested, there's also been a number of other ones. The Trump administration did a similar effort to reorganize office structures and realign them. Like the rest of DHS, INA has just undergone reorganizations every few years. And there's probably only so many things that you can do with an agency without kind of like getting at those fundamental activities that it engages in. To the right and the left coming together, it's funny because Project 2025, right, which was the Heritage Foundation's platform and proposal for a conservative agenda, actually calls to shut down INA. Pretty straightforward, just shut the office down, because it recognizes that the agency is in a position to target Americans for their speech and can be easily abused across administrations. There's people on the Hill who feel similarly. There's also people in Congress who see the value that INA can bring and are optimistic that some of these reforms can fix it. I think there's probably opportunity to take some of those basic and important information sharing functions, right? Getting federal, state, and local agencies to talk to each other and maybe reallocating them to other parts of DHS that already have liaison functions.
So
Go ahead.
To try to simplify it. So your recommendation, I want to put words in your mouth. I'd rather have you say it. DHS should get out of the business of collecting intelligence. It has a legitimate function of receiving intelligence from other agencies and spreading it around so that all the relevant agencies know about security threats.
Yeah, I think so. With INA specifically, I think it's past time for Congress to end its domestic intelligence operations. That collection, retention, and dissemination of intelligence that it's developed in-house organically, I think the risks are significant, and the value has often been missing. And it's an incredibly difficult job to get right, and they've tried many times to do it. And while I'm optimistic about some of the things in the latest reform manual about those processes for documenting materials, I'm concerned that there are not really any changes in terms of the substance and standards of their work, going especially into an administration that has promised, committed, and run and won on cracking down on dissent.
All right. So there we have it. Get rid of it. Start over. Draw up some new plans, but get out of the collection business. It still has a legitimate function of passing around information from other agencies or ones within its umbrella. However, even that should be limited to a great degree, because a lot of unverified is used for field intelligence operations of, let's say, ICE, Border Patrol, and so on. They need their own intelligence collection abilities, but they can keep it to themselves. It doesn't need to be spread around all these agencies and possibly misused. Well, Spencer Reynolds, thanks so much for spending all this time. It's a thorny subject. It's a difficult subject. We have a lot of internal and foreign threats coming in. DHS was created to kind of deal with these and it's had some successes, not a lot. But there it is. Here we are. So thanks for coming on the Spy Talk podcast and talking about it with us.
Thank you, Jeff. Appreciate the opportunity to chat.
And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Thanks much for listening. You can find lots more interesting conversations like this one in our archives, available at our home at MSW Network or on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't already, mosey on over to our Spy Talk newsletter on Substack, where my colleagues and I offer fresh reporting and analyses from the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google Spy Talk. You'll find your way there. This week's Spy Talk podcast was smoothly produced, as always, by Kanai and expertly edited by Molly Hawkey for MSW Media. And that's it. I'm Jeff Stein. See you around.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to spytalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MSW Media.
Hi, I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.